This is a podcast from The Red House, the former home of Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers. I'm Lucy Walker. Join me, colleagues and other guests for a monthly chat about all things Britten and Piers, plus music, culture, heritage in general, and anything else that might come up. Welcome to From the Red House podcast. This is season 3, episode 3, and I'm really thrilled to be joined by Jamie Njoku Goodwin, who's chief executive of UK Music and also a new trustee of Britten Piers Arts. So welcome, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
So we're just going to have a chat about music in general. But first of all, I'm really curious about your background. And as I quite often find in these podcasts, it's always really interesting to find out how people got interested in classical music and where that first started. Do you want to perhaps just say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think my real passion for classical music came quite late, actually. I'd sort of had some keyboard lessons when I was younger. I tried and failed to play the violin and not really got anywhere with that. But it wasn't until I was actually 17. There's an amazing charity called the Cavatina Music Trust that is focused on taking particularly disadvantaged young people to classical music concerts and introducing them to chamber music. And they've got this wonderful program where they'd give tickets to young people and get them to concerts. And when I was 17, I was lucky enough to be invited along to a concert. It was at the Wigmore Hall, and I remember sitting through it, and it was kind of quite a new experience for me. It was the Beethoven Opus 18, number 6, which I found incredibly boring. It was the Brahms A minor string quartet, which I found even more dull. And then it was Ligeti's Metamorphosis Nocturnes, which, if anyone knows it, is completely out there. It's crazy. It's wild. It's sort of very kind of avant-garde and modernist, and not the sort of thing that you'd think a 17-year-old who wasn't really interested in classical music would be gripped by, but it completely blew me away. And I left that concert just being like, wow, I want to know more about this. So I ended up going to university to do music. It sparked a real passion for me. I just obsessed about it for the next kind of couple of years. Ended off going off to Nottingham to go and do music, where I then developed a big love of, in particular, Brahms and Beethoven. So I always feel really strange. It feels very strange to me thinking that that first concert that really exposed me to it was two pieces which I now adore, but actually found really disinteresting at the time, which actually is an interesting mark of how pieces sometimes change for you and how you can be exposed to something at some point in your life and not really be particularly interested in it, and it'll be the other thing that will completely grip you. Then years or even decades later, sometimes you find yourself reassessing things and having a completely new view on things. But I went to Nottingham to go and do music. I studied music at Nottingham for 3 years. And then when I graduated, I moved into the world of politics, but kept up a keen interest in music and particular classical music. I was a very bad pianist and a very bad amateur conductor. And there have been, particularly at university, orchestras who've been subjected to my baton, which probably still have the bad memories of it. But I was a keen amateur that I kept up when I moved back to London and started working in the political world.
Wow, I'm really intrigued that the Ligeti grabbed you kind of instinctively rather than the Beethoven and the Brahms. Could you put your finger on why the Ligeti was the thing that really got you to start with?
No, and that's what makes it so fast. Like, I'm fascinated by the fact that you could put 1,000 people in a concert hall and every single one of them will have a completely different emotional reaction to a piece of music. Yeah. I think actually that's one of the things that makes live music in particular, but music generally, is so wonderful. I don't think you can really predict how people will respond to things. And it's not just the piece itself. Sometimes it's the performance. I remember seeing Mahler, the Berlin Field in Mahler 2, kind of on the greatest orchestra in the world, completely didn't get it at all, and it just did nothing for me. And then seeing an amateur orchestra do it about a year and a half later, they completely butchered it. It was all over the place, but it just really moved me, and I was obsessed with it after that. And actually, it's one of the things, it's fascinating just about the way that some pieces will grip you, some pieces won't, some performances will, some performances won't, but you can walk out of a concert hall and walk out of a concert having have your life changed by something. And that's one of the things that I think makes so many people so passionate about, in particular, live music.
Definitely, definitely so. And I think it's really interesting that, I mean, partly why I was interested in your reaction to the Ligeti is that people there can be a common view that contemporary music is extremely difficult, and it's gonna nobody's gonna want to listen to it. It's really hard to get people engaged in it, and it's something that you find even cultural commentators who quite happily talk about quite way out films or art or books struggle to talk about more contemporary music in that way, as if it is seen as, but often it has that real visceral impact on people.
It does, though people often overthink that. So I took a few friends about 5 years ago to the Royal Festival Hall where they did the Ligeti Full String Orchestra, actually. It was a string orchestra concert. They did the, it was a concert all about Metamorphosis. I think they did Strauss, and then they did the Heather Quartet doing the Ligeti. And it didn't have nearly as much of an impact as it had on me as it had 10 years before, interestingly. But the thing I found most fascinating was the people I took, they found the Strauss as inaccessible as the Ligeti. And sometimes, it's difficult. It's why pre-concert talks are often fascinating, aren't they? Because the number of people I've gone to concerts with who've not really got something, not really understood something, but if they've had someone talking to them about it for 15 minutes before, they feel like they know something, they feel like they understand it, they feel like they can engage with it so much more. And it's almost, sometimes that, I was going to say illusion of education, that's probably a strange phrase, but the sense that you can understand what's behind something often makes it much easier to engage with than otherwise. But I don't know, it's still sometimes a mystery to me.
No, I absolutely. And as you say, overthinking it can, I don't know, perhaps get in the way sometimes of that just instinctive emotional reaction. But at the same time, having a piece of work described or giving people some navigational tools, I suppose, especially if it's a big piece and someone might be nervous about just not understanding the journey of it.
Yeah, it's tools. I think it's also confidence. Mm. It's giving people the confidence to engage with something. Because it can be really, really terrifying to be sat there listening to something you don't really know about or don't really understand. The one I always think of is Piotr Zak. Mm-hmm. So Piotr Zak was I think it was in the 50s. It was this experiment by a couple of BBC producers where they just put some tapes on, did a few whistles, and then played it on Radio 3, I think. And they had all these critics saying, oh, it was marvellous it did this, or it was marvellous it did that. And basically because people thought they had a reference point for it, they thought they understood it, and they thought they could draw meaning from it. When sometimes, actually, the meaning you think you're drawing from something, I mean, it's not necessarily true, and it's not necessarily right, but often it's what's the impression it's had on you as a listener, and what's the impact it's had on you emotionally. And even if it's something that's been completely contrived, it can't have an emotional impact on you.
Mm. No, absolutely. Well, I think as human beings, I think we're all doomed to seek meaning, whatever it is we're listening to. You try and find patterns, you respond to it. And I think that's just what we do. And I think that, as you say, in a concert hall, you'll have 1,000 different meanings being generated, which is what is lovely about live performance, which we're all obviously hoping to get back to as soon as is humanly possible. And just on that, your role in UK music, I just wanted to move on to that for a bit. When did you take up your post as chief executive?
So I started about 6 months ago. It was in October 2020. So about 6 months ago now. Mm-hmm. I should just probably explain a little bit about it. It was established about 12 or 13 years ago with the aim that the music industry and the music sector as a whole was made up of lots of sometimes disparate bodies, many kind of established bodies within their own rights, who had different objectives, different agendas. And as an industry, it's a huge industry. It's a £5.8 billion industry supporting 200,000 jobs. You'd have the Musicians Union representing musicians. You'd have kind of the BPI and AIM who are representing record labels and the independent record label sector. You'd have your PRS and PPL who are representing royalty and collection societies, who are the collection societies. You'd have the FAC representing artists, you have the MPG representing sound engineers, the Music Publishers Association representing publishers, and you'd have a lot of different bodies who all do fantastic work in and of themselves. But the issue you had was there was never really a single unified voice for the music industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. And government would often find itself in a bit of a pickle. They want to know what the music industry view was, but because there are so many bodies, there was no real clear it's a bit like the that Kissinger thing. When you want to speak to Europe, who do you pick up the phone to? Was what he always used to say. And government used to sometimes find the problem was, who do you pick up the phone to? Who do you actually speak to for a unified view from the whole music industry, from the whole music sector? And so UK Music was formed to bring together lots of those different organisations and be able to represent a collective view, sort of be the collective voice of the UK music industry, representing all sectors of the industry and bringing together lots of bits of the industry, not just to campaign and champion music, but also to resolve issues and make sure that we can be unified as a sector. And I think in the past year, that's been needed now more than ever.
Yeah.
When you're at a point of crisis, and when you're having every single other industry feeling under the cosh, every single other industry feeling like the pandemic has impacted them, make sure you've got a body that can be engaging with government, lobbying government, airing the issues that that are impacting the music industry, whether it be the need to be able to get back to having live events again safely, whether it be the plight of freelancers and those working in the sector. But as the impact on the industry has been absolutely decimating. Mm-hmm. And for the hundreds of thousands of people who work within it, many who are freelancers, self-employed people, don't have the sort of employment benefits or the social security benefits that lots of people in kind of full-time employed work might have. And many people, I mean, I hear from people every day, that they haven't been able to access some of the support schemes. They've had to be looking at taking up new jobs, and it's been devastating for the, not just for the industry, but for the thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who work within it, who basically make it what it is. And sometimes it's the border issues as well. It's the post-pandemic issues. It's, well, Brexit has been a big one that we've been focusing lots on. And the challenges that many people work in this sector are going to be having when looking to work in Europe continually over the next kind of months and years. And the broader element of how do we make our music industry, essentially, well, how do we make the UK the best place in the world to create, produce and enjoy music is the sort of the personal mission statement I've set for myself. What do we need to do to make sure that the UK, which has got hundreds of years of history of developing great musical talent, great musical audiences, and exports the world as a musical, as a home of music, how do we ensure that we can be as strong and as successful going forward as we have in the past?
Yeah. Yes, goodness. I wonder whether you have any challenges in persuading people of it. I mean, obviously, the figures should speak for themselves, clearly, but you occasionally hear sort of mutterings from people that classical music or the arts in general are just the kind of fluff that's only for a certain sector of society, and it's not a proper job, or, you know, people think that when you go to university you ought to learn something that's going to earn you money, so you do something practical or career oriented, and that music can get and is being sort of squished, certainly in schools, commonly out of the curriculum. It's seen as a sort of, as I say, as something alongside an academic aspiration rather than actually being central to it or part of a rounded education. Do you find that you have any challenges in that sort of area of persuading people of its worth?
Yeah, I think lots of people have for a long time. And strangely, actually, the problem we've got is because it's so loved. Mm. It's so enjoyed. If you sort of say the sectors that are really important to the UK economy, it sounds very dry. And you'd think it's things like, obviously, engineering, automotive, fishing is the one that often kind of gets mentioned. But actually, the arts and creative subjects, because people love them and have such kind of passion and enthusiasm for, it's often really easy for people, and particularly policymakers, to realise just how vitally important they are. So the creative industries in the UK contribute £116 billion a year to the economy. Now, that's bigger than the automotive sector. It's pretty much as big as our finance sector. It's a huge part of our economy. And in particular, the music industry, it contributes £5.8 billion a year to the economy. It supports 200,000 jobs. It generates £2.9 billion a year of exports. Economically, it's absolutely huge. It's a sort of sector that we should be actively not just protecting, but promoting, championing, and ensuring that is a sector that could be helping drive our post-pandemic recovery. In the past year, lots of people have felt that their jobs haven't been viable because of our live activity being stopped and not much being able to happen on the live performance front. Actually, the strange thing is, if you look over the next 10 years, there's a big debate at the moment about automation and what sort of jobs are going to be resistant to automation and what the jobs of the future are. Actually, the creative jobs are the jobs of the future. If there's one thing we've learned in the past year, it's that you can't you can't automate creativity. And even though we've done a lot of really interesting things with live streaming and trying to keep some concerts going where we can, we have learned that there is actually no real substitute for live music. So that wider economic argument, there's such a compelling wider economic argument that we could be making about the music industry. But for me, it's not just about the economic argument. I think the economic argument is very important, but it's not just the only thing. The social benefits are huge. So the impact on mental health and well-being, there's more research emerging all the time about the huge positive benefits that music can have on mental health. I always use the example of Paul Harvey. So this is, it's really worth looking up for those who haven't seen it. I think Nick Harvey, his father, Paul Harvey, is a composer with dementia, I believe. Mm. And there's this amazing video of Nick Harvey playing his dad four notes on the piano. Mm. And his dad just improvising those four notes and just coming alive. And I will say pharmaceutical companies spend hundreds of millions of pounds every year trying to find new drugs and cures for dementia and new drugs and new treatments and things that can help support people with dementia and with wider mental health and well-being issues. Four notes on the piano did more for him than many hundreds of millions of pounds of research and innovation have done for many others. And I'm not saying that research isn't important, it's vitally important, but the role and the positive benefit that music can have on people's lives is absolutely huge. And it does mean that it's something that matters to so many of us, and it's something that we should be promoting. So not just for the economic benefit, but the social benefit, the positive educational benefit. It's amazing when you look at companies these days that are saying we want to be hiring creative people. It's not the old-fashioned, again, nothing against PPE or history or geography, but if you speak to companies like Google, they want people from creative backgrounds. They want people that think, that have kind of a creative education. And the idea that a music degree or study music or drama or art at school sort of shouldn't be the dumb thing or isn't the benefit is just completely wrong. Yeah. And the thing that always depresses me is that if you're a struggling state school with small budgets, the first thing that often goes is your art subjects.
Exactly. Yeah.
And often you have schools in the independent sector that have got slightly more of a budget, have good arts provision, good music provision, good drama provision. And that often means it puts people from those backgrounds and from those sort of educational spheres often in a much better position 10, 15 years later in their career, because they've been learning all sorts of skills that, even though sometimes some people don't really realise the impact and the positive impact that creative education can have on people. And it's really important that we continue to make that argument, I think.
Absolutely so. I mean, you speak so passionately about it, and it's brilliant that the industry has such a powerful advocate in that sense, because it's just... It gets so frustrating when it's considered of lesser impact, because again, there can be all sorts of assumptions about classical music that it's only, you have to be of a certain socioeconomic background or generation to enjoy it or to respond to it in any way. And all organisations, and rightly so, are working towards expanding their audiences and working out how best to do that.
Exactly. One of the biggest reasons people are musical fans, or fans of not just classical music but of most genres, is because they're exposed to it when they were younger. Mm. You know, because of just going on to it for the fun of it. If you're exposed to it when you're younger, you're more likely to have a relationship with it, and to be the sort of person that's going to be enjoying it, consuming it, and going along to concerts and supporting orchestras. So actually, what you want to be doing, again, when you go to concerts and you look around the audience, often it doesn't necessarily look particularly sustainable sometimes. And it's in our interest to make sure that we are attracting as many people from as many different backgrounds, as many different walks of life as possible. Yeah. Not just because I think it's good, it's in their interest to be exposed to this amazing, often life-changing experiences, but it's also in our interest as an industry to ensure that we've got as wide an audience base. Because in 20 or 30 years' time, and even sooner, we don't want to be in a position where we wished it was something we don't want to be thinking, if only 20 years ago we'd have really kind of put a lot more effort into this. It's something we should really be doing now, for the future sustainability of the industry.
What What are your thoughts on that and on how to get younger people more engaged in classical music?
That is a big question.
No, sorry, you don't have to solve it, you know, the next 5 minutes.
Some people think just playing someone something is going to get them interested in it. I always really passionately disagree with that. This is probably very naive, but if everyone sung in a choir from the age of 5, you'd have a completely different future for the industry and the sector. Most people that I've, even now, just the experience of singing in a choir. My mum adores playing in her recorder group, and she's done so since she was about sort of like 8 or 9 years old, and it's something that kind of really inspired and made her really passionate about it. The act of performing in things and just performing musically, I mean, this is just my experience, but the things that made me most passionate about many things and many pieces of music has been singing them, has been performing them. The Proms, every year they do a wonderful come and sing for one of the choral works. You can apply a few weeks before, and they'll get you all into the hall before, and you'll sing with the orchestra. And it's absolutely amazing. I did one with, I think it was a Beethoven 9, and I can't remember what the orchestra was, but they were doing Beethoven 9 at the Proms in the evening. And kind of, they just got 300 people to come and stand in the choir stalls, and you did 2 hours on it. There were people in that, I remember there were people in that couldn't read music. There were people in that had no idea really what they were doing, and they just come along because they wanted to give it a go. And every single person you spoke to afterwards was so inspired, so enthused. And it didn't just mean that, I think they enjoyed the concert even more because they felt like they tried it, but it gave them a real stake, and it gave them a real sense of realizing just how passionate they are about it. And I wonder if the distinction between audience and performer is often reinforced slightly too much sometimes. Often audience members are passionate about music because they are musicians. And you can either say, right, do we therefore try and make more non-musicians audience members, or can you flip down his head and say, how do we make more audience members musicians? And how can we try and give people the experience of trying to do things, whether it's singing in the choir, whether it's teaching someone to record at school, whether it's making sure that you've got ensembles at school from a young age where people can really develop the passion for this. Because I genuinely believe that there's no one who doesn't enjoy or won't have a passion for music. I just think that not everyone's found the thing that's really going to ignite that passion yet.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I went to a state school that was very strong in music. I mean, this was quite a long time ago now, but everybody in our year was exposed to music at quite a high level until obviously they chose to drop it. But those that took it further, so took it to GCSE, took it to A level, and those that I'm still in touch with have maintained that connection to live performance throughout their adult lives in all sorts of different ways. So whether they play, like a friend of mine who still plays the trumpet with her local amateur orchestra, another one has just started teaching her daughter the flute, which is what she played at school, and I obviously have gone into it in a big way as well. So it does stay with you and isn't something that you think is an unusual part of your life. It's just embedded and was from a really early age.
Absolutely. And it's, I think, completely agree. I think it's emotionally embedded in it rather than just intellectually embedded in it.
Completely.
So there's obviously a big campaign to make sure that music can be part of the EBAC and say music should be taught in schools, which I think is important, but it almost misses the point of it. Again, I went to a state school that didn't have a huge amount of budget and a huge amount of provision, and the focus around making sure the music is on the curriculum would probably benefit schools that have got good arts provision already, good creative provision already, and often do quite a lot of this stuff sort of anyway. Actually, it's not just about making sure music's on the curriculum. It should be on the curriculum, but it shouldn't really end there. It should also be a part of young people's lives. It should be extracurricular as well as curricular, but it should be the sort of thing that we should be, as you say, like embedding in school life. Things I always hear about people talking about how they used to sing hymns and things in assemblies, and I always think that's a really nice thing to be doing, sort of having children from a really young age being used to singing in harmony with each other. Yeah. And it can sometimes sound a bit sort of old-fashioned, but I do think it's one of those things that could have a really positive impact for lots of people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of an age when we were still singing hymns in certainly in middle school, and I remember that experience quite vividly. And also, it's just, we had this incredibly theatrical headmaster when I was at middle school who used to like to stride in to school assembly to music, and it was something quite extraordinary like the Ride of the Valkyries or, you know, some incredibly loud piece of music, and he would come marching in, stand on the stage tapping his foot and then nod to turn it off, and then we would have school assembly. Extraordinary showman. But that stayed with me, and I've still got a fondness for really bombastic orchestral music as a result of Mr. Hall. So now you're trustee also of Britain Peers Arts. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. No, I'm really, really excited. I've only started a few weeks or so ago, but no, incredibly excited to be part of this, especially because, and it comes back to some things we were talking about the value of music and the argument about not just the economic, but also the social benefits of music. The thing I found really inspiring about Britain Peers Arts is that almost that founding creed of, I think, yeah, was it Britain said, of making the arts useful. And I always have to phrase this really carefully, because whenever you say to people, talk about making the arts useful, people rightly say, hang on, the arts are already useful. And actually sort of, my experience in particular, sitting and listening to a concert in itself is useful, and it has all sorts of positive, useful benefits. But an organisation that's really focused on all those positive benefits of really blending high artistic quality output with a focus on future talent, but also the focus on the wider positive impacts and influences that music can have, yeah, is incredibly exciting, and I think incredibly timely as well. The two things that are going to be most impacted by this pandemic long term, for me, are the mental health and wellbeing toll and the educational toll. They're going to be two of the things that even in 5 or 10 years' time, you'll be seeing people doing charts and graphs where you'll see a huge dip, and that dip will be put down to what's happened in the past year. Yeah. And so really looking at how the arts can play that positive role on the mental health and wellbeing side, and particularly lots of the work that we do on social prescribing, is incredibly exciting. Yeah. And hopefully it does mean that as we come out of this, the importance of music and the value of music is going to be recognised even more so post-pandemic than it was beforehand.
I have no doubt at all. So we're just coming to the end, and as usual, I'd like to ask for a couple of tracks for our podcast playlist of a couple of things that you've been listening to that you might want to share.
Yeah, great. Well, how about this? To round this off, the first one I'll do is The Ligeti. It's a string quartet number one, the Metamorphosis Nocturnes. They're fascinating. And they were, it was post Second World War. Ligeti had an awful experience. His family had an awful experience during the Second World War. And it's a gripping piece of music, probably for those who are familiar with his work, but also for those who are just coming to particularly contemporary music. Although that was my experience, it'd be fascinating. Some people will listen to it and be completely uninterested, and others will be completely gripped and amazed by it. So my second one, something I've been listening to actually again and again and again, it's Max Richter. It's The Waves. I never got to see it when it was being performed, and I kept hearing rumours about a potential return. I'm really hoping it's actually going to be the case, because I've only ever experienced it recorded. I've never heard it live. But it just, particularly the finale, it just washes over you. And given it's sort of a musical setting of Virginia Woolf's suicide and her suicide letter. Goodness. And it's magnificent in a really, I'm trying to think how to phrase it now, because it's saying magnificent about something that's a setting of what is essentially someone's suicide sounds like bizarre, but it's incredibly moving. I mean, I love Max Richter. He's phenomenal. And I don't think anyone since Brahms has had an ability to use timbre and texture like Richter does. It's amazing, and he can do things that aren't hugely innovative in a harmonic sense, and he can have sometimes very, very, very clear and succinct, and when I say simple, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, ideas that he encapsulated and presents in such a fantastic, fascinated way through the medium of the orchestra. Every time I listen to it, you discover something new in it. So I'll have those two as my recommendations.
Brilliant, making me want to go straight and listen to them. So that's absolutely what the what the point was. So that's great. I'm just going to contribute a couple. I was thinking when you're talking about Ligeti that he's quite often used in film soundtracks, and I think that people can be exposed to all kinds of quite way out classical music through film soundtracks, whether it's specially composed or it's someone like Martin Scorsese, who in this film Shutter Island uses this incredible playlist of contemporary music, as well as some Mahler as well. But Ligeti features quite strongly in that. And this other piece by an Italian composer called Giacinto Scelsi, who I'd never heard of before I did a project recently. And he's got a piece called Waxuktum, The Legend of the Mayan City, which they themselves destroyed for religious reasons, which is one heck of a title. And it's quite the piece. It's a big old orchestral crazy thing with cast of thousands and a choir. So that is going in, if only for its title. But also, I think, just for that impulse to encourage people to listen to slightly more unusual things that they might not be drawn to otherwise. And then just a really sunny song, Canic Chase by Labi Siffre, which I've been listening to a lot as the weather's got better. And it's just lovely. It just makes you smile. So that's going in too.
Marvellous.
Thank you so much for the conversation. It's been really fascinating to hear about your work and your aspirations. And I wish you every, success and energy for the coming challenges for UK music.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on.
Pleasure.